Cassette 4, Side 2. One of them levitated over a piece to the cable and latched onto the track inlaid in the cable's west side and rose up soundlessly through a valve door in the collar. The travelers and their escorts got out of their car. Nergal was withdrawn, already on his way. Maya and Michelle excited. Sax, his usual self. One by one, they hugged Art and Coyote, stretching up to Art, leaning down to Desmond. For a time, they all talked at once, staring at each other, trying to comprehend the moment. It was just a trip, but it felt like more than that. Then the four travelers crossed the floor and disappeared into a jetway leading up into the next elevator car. After that, Coyote and Art stood there and watched the car float over to the cable and rise through the valve door and disappear. Coyote's asymmetrical face clenched into a most uncharacteristic expression of worry, even fear. That was his son, of course, and three of his closest friends going to a very dangerous place. Well, it was just Earth. But it felt dangerous, Art had to admit. "They'll be okay," Art said, giving the little man a squeeze on the shoulder. "There'll be stars down there. It'll go fine." No doubt true. In fact, he felt better himself at his own reassurances. It was the home planet, after all. Humans were made for it. They would be fine. It was the home planet. Still. Back in East Pavonis, the Congress had begun. It was Nadia's doing, really. She simply started working in the main warehouse on draft passages, and people started joining her, and things snowballed. Once the meetings were going, people had to attend or risk losing a say. Nadia shrugged if anyone complained that they weren't ready, that things had to be regularized, that they needed to know more, etc. "Come on," she said impatiently. "Here we are. We might as well get to it." So a fluctuating group of about 300 people began meeting daily in the industrial complex of East Pavonis. The main warehouse, designed to hold pieced parts and train cars, was huge, and scores of mobile-walled offices were set up against its walls, leaving the central space open and available for a roughly circular collection of mismatched tables. "Ah," Art said when he saw it, "the table of tables." Of course, there were people who wanted a list of delegates, so that they knew who could vote, who could speak, and so on. Nadia, who was quickly taking on the role of chairperson, suggested they accept all requests to become a delegation from any Martian group, as long as the group had had some tangible existence before the conference began. "We might as well be inclusive." The constitutional scholars from Dorsa Brevia agreed that the Congress should be conducted by members of voting delegations, and the final result then voted on by the populace at large. Charlotte, who had helped to draft the Dorsa Brevia document 12 years before, had led a group since then in working up plans for a government in anticipation of a successful revolution. They weren't the only ones to have done this. Schools in South Fossa and at the university in Sabashii had taught courses in the matter, and many of the young natives in the warehouse were well-versed in the issues they were tackling. "It's kind of scary," Art remarked to Nadia. "Win a revolution, and a bunch of lawyers pop out of the woodwork." "Always." Charlotte's group had made a list of potential delegates to a constitutional congress, including all Martian settlements with populations over 500. Quite a few people would therefore be represented twice, Nadia pointed out, once by location and again by political affiliation. The few groups not on the list complained to a new committee, which allowed almost all petitioners to join. And Art made a call to Derek Hastings and extended an invitation to Unta to join as a delegation as well. The surprised Hastings got back to them a few days later with a positive response. He would come down the cable himself. And so after about a week's jockeying, with many other matters being worked on at the same time, they had enough agreement to call for a vote of approval of the delegate list. And because it had been so inclusive, it passed almost unanimously. And suddenly, they had a real Congress. It was made up of the following delegations, with anywhere from 1 to 10 people in each delegation. Towns: Acheron, Nicosia, Cairo, Odessa, Harmachis Vallis, Sabashi, Christianopolis, Bogdanov Vishniak, Hiranya Garba, Moss Hyde, Sheffield, Senzeni Na, Ekus Overlook, Dorsa Brevia, Dow Vallis, South Fossa, Rumi, New Vanuatu, Prometheus, Gramsci, New Clark, Bradbury Point, Sergei Korolyov, Dumathrae Crater, South Station, Rule Vallis, Southern Caravanserai, Nuovo Bologna, Nirgal Vallis, Monte Pulciano, Mariotis, Burroughs Refugees Organization, Libya Station, Tharsis Tholis, Overhangs, Margaritifer Plinth, Great Escarpment Caravanserai, Da Vinci, the Elysian League, Hell's Gate. Political parties and other organizations: Boonians, Reds, Bogdanovists, Schnellingistas, Mars First, Free Mars, the Ka, Praxis, Kahiran Majari League, Green Mars, United Nations Transitional Authority, Kakazi, Editorial Board of the Journal of Aerological Studies, Space Elevator Authority, Christian Democrats, the Metanational Economic Activity Coordination Committee, Bolognian Neo-Marxists, Friends of the Earth, Biotique, Séparation de l'Atmosphère. General meetings began in the morning around the table of tables, then moved out in many small working groups to offices in the warehouse or buildings nearby. Every morning, Art showed up early and brewed great pots of coffee, kava, and kava java, his favorite. It perhaps wasn't much of a job, given the significance of the enterprise, but Art was happy doing it. Every day he was surprised to see a Congress convening at all, and observing the size of it, he felt that helping to get it started was probably going to be his principal contribution. He wasn't a scholar, and he had few ideas about what a Martian constitution ought to include. Getting people together was what he was good at, and he had done that. Or rather, he and Nadia had, for Nadia had stepped in and taken the lead just when they had needed her. She was the only one of the first 100 on hand who had everyone's trust. This gave her a bit of genuine natural authority. Now, without any fuss, without seeming to notice, she was doing it. She was exerting that power. And so now it was Art's great pleasure to become, in effect, Nadia's personal assistant. He arranged her days and did everything he could to make sure they ran smoothly. This included making a good pot of kava java first thing every morning, for Nadia was one of many of them fond of that initial jolt toward alertness and general goodwill. Yes, Art thought, personal assistant and drug dispenser. That was his destiny at this point in history. And he was happy. Just watching people look at Nadia was a pleasure in itself. And the way she looked back, interested, sympathetic, skeptical, an edge developing quickly if she thought someone was wasting her time, a warmth kindling if she was impressed by their contribution. And people knew this. They wanted to please her. They tried to keep to the point to make a contribution. They wanted that particular warm look in her eye. Very strange eyes they were, really, when you looked close. Hazel, basically, but flecked with innumerable tiny patches of other colors: yellow, black, green, blue. A mesmerizing quality to them. Nadia focused her full attention on people. She was willing to believe you, to take your side, to make sure your case didn't get lost in the shuffle. Even the Reds, who knew she had been fighting with Anne, trusted her to make sure they were heard. so the work coalesced around her, and all art really had to do was watch her at work and enjoy it and help where he could. And so the debates began. In the first week, many arguments concerned simply what a constitution was, what form it should take, and whether they should have one at all. Charlotte called this the meta-conflict, the argument about what the argument was about. A very important matter, she said when she saw Nadia squint unhappily, because in settling it, we set the limits on what we can decide. If we decide to include economic and social issues in the Constitution, for instance, then this is a very different kind of thing than if we stick to purely political or legal matters, or to a very general statement of principles. To help structure even this debate, she and the Dorsa Brevia scholars had come with a number of different blank constitutions, which blocked out different kinds of constitutions without actually filling in their contents. These blanks did little, however, to stop the objections of those who maintained that most aspects of social and economic life ought not to be regulated at all. Support for such a minimal state came from a variety of viewpoints that otherwise made strange bedfellows: anarchists, libertarians, neo-traditional capitalists, certain greens, and so on. To the most extreme of these anti-statists, writing up any government at all was a kind of defeat, and they conceived of their role in the Congress as making the new government as small as possible. Sachs heard about this argument in one of the nightly calls from Nadia and Art, and he was as willing to think about it seriously as he was anything else. It's been found that a few simple rules can regulate very complex behavior. There's a classic computer model for flocking birds, for instance, which only has three rules: keep an equal distance from everyone around you, don't change speed too fast, avoid stationary objects. Those will model the flight of a flock quite nicely. A computer flock, maybe? Nadia scoffed. Have you ever seen chimney swifts at dusk? After a moment, Sax's reply arrived. No. Well, take a look when you get to Earth. Meanwhile, we can't be having a constitution that says only, don't change speed too fast. Art thought this was funny, but Nadia was not amused. In general, she had little patience for the minimalist arguments. Isn't it the equivalent of letting the metanats run things? She would say. Letting might be right. No, no, Mikhail would protest. That's not what we mean at all. It seems very like what you're saying. And for some, it's obviously a kind of cover, a pretend principle that's really about keeping the rules that protect their property and privileges and letting the rest go to hell. No, not at all. Then you must prove it at the table. Everything that government might involve itself in, you have to make the case against. You have to argue it point by point. And she was so insistent about this, not scolding like Maya would have, but simply adamant, that they had to agree. Everything was at least on the table for discussion. Therefore, the various blank constitutions made sense as starting points, and therefore they should get on with it. A vote on it was taken, and the majority agreed to give it a try. And so there they were, the first hurdle jumped. Everyone had agreed to work according to the same plan. It was amazing, Art thought, zooming from meeting to meeting, filled with admiration for Nadia. She wasn't your ordinary diplomat. She by no means followed the empty vessel model that Art aspired to, but things got done nevertheless. She had the charisma of the sensible. He hugged her every time he passed her. He kissed the top of her head. He loved her. He ran around with that wealth of good feeling and dropped in on all the sessions he could, watching to see how he could help keep things going. Often it was just a matter of supplying people with food and drink so that they could continue through the day without getting irritable. At all hours, the table of tables was crowded, fresh-faced young Valkyries towering over sun-baked old vets, all races, all types. This was Mars, Emir 52. a kind of de facto United Nations all on its own, with all the potential fractiousness of that notoriously fractious body, so that sometimes, looking at all their disparate faces and listening to the melange of languages, English augmented by Babel, art was nearly overwhelmed by their variety. "Ka, Nadia," he said as they sat eating sandwiches and going over their notes for the day. "We're trying to write a constitution that every Terran culture could agree to." She waved the problem away, swallowed. "About time," she said. Charlotte suggested that the Dorsa Brevia Declaration made a logical starting point for discussing the content that would fill the constitutional forms. This suggestion caused more trouble than even the blanks had, for the Reds and several other delegations disliked various points of the old declaration, and they argued that using it was a way of pasting the Congress from the start. "So what?" Nadia said. "We can change every word of it if we want, but we have to start with something." This view was popular among most of the old underground groups, many of whom had been at Dorsa Brevia in M39. The declaration that had resulted remained the underground's best effort to write down what they had agreed on back when they were out of power, so it made sense to start with it. It gave them some precedent, some historical continuity. When they pulled it out and looked at it, however, they found that the old declaration had become frighteningly radical. No private property? No appropriation of surplus value? Had they really said such things? How were things supposed to work? People pored over the bare, uncompromising sentences, shaking their heads. The declaration hadn't bothered to say how its lofty goals were to be enacted. It had only stated them. The stone tablet routine, as Art characterized it. But now the revolution had succeeded, and the time had come to do something in the real world. Could they really stick to concepts as radical as those in the Dorsa Brevia Declaration? Hard to say. "At least the points are there to discuss," Nadia said. And along with them, on everyone's screen, were the blank constitutions with their section headings, suggesting all by themselves the many problems they were going to have to come to grips with. Structure of government, executive. Structure of government, legislative. Structure of government, judicial. Rights of citizens, military and police. Taxation, election procedures, property law, economic systems, environmental law, amendment procedures, and so on. In some blanks, for pages on end. All being juggled on everyone's screens, scrambled, formatted, endlessly debated. "Just filling in the blanks," as Art sang one night, looking over Nadia's shoulder at one particularly forbidding flowchart pattern, like something out of Michel's Alchemical Combinatoires. And Nadia laughed. The working groups focused on different parts of government as outlined in a new composite blank constitution, now being called the Blank of Blanks. Political parties and interest groups gravitated to the issues that most concerned them, and the many tent town delegations chose or were assigned to remaining areas. After that, it was a matter of work. For the moment, the Da Vinci Crater Technical Group was in control of Martian space. They were keeping all space shuttles from docking at Clark or aerobraking into Martian orbit. No one believed that this alone made them truly free, but it did give them a certain amount of physical and psychic space to work in. This was the gift of the revolution. They were also driven by the memory of the battle for Sheffield. The fear of civil war was strong among them. Anne was in exile with the Kakazi, and sabotage in the outback was a daily occurrence. There were also tents that had declared independence from anyone, and a few Metanat holdouts. There was turmoil generally, and a sense of barely contained confusion. They were in a bubble in history, a moment only. It could collapse any time, and if they didn't act soon, it would collapse. It was, simply put, time to act. This was the one thing everyone agreed on, but it was a very important thing. As the days passed, a core group of workers slowly emerged, people who recognized each other for their willingness to get the job done, for their desire to finish paragraphs rather than posture. Inside all the rest of the debate, these people went at it, guided by Nadia, who was very quick to recognize such people and give them all the help she could. Art, meanwhile, ran around in his usual manner. Up early, supplied drinks and food and information concerning the work ongoing in other rooms. It seemed to him that things were going pretty well. Most of the subgroups took the responsibility to fill in their blanks seriously, writing and rewriting drafts, hammering them out concept by concept, phrase by phrase. They were happy to see Art when he came by in the course of the day, as he represented a break, some food, some jokes. One judicial group tacked foam wings on his shoes and sent him with a caustic message along to an executive group with whom they were fighting. Pleased, Art kept the wings on. Why not? What they were doing had a kind of ludicrous majesty, or majestic ludicrousness. They were rewriting the rules. He was flying around like Hermes or Puck. It was perfectly appropriate. And so he flew through the long hours into the night, every night. And after all the sessions had closed down for the evening, he went back to the praxis offices he shared with Nadia, and they would eat and talk over the day's progress, and make a call to the travelers to Earth, and talk with Nergal and Sax and Maya and Michelle. And after that, Nadia would go back to work at her screens, usually falling asleep there in her chair. Then Art would often go back out into the warehouse, and the buildings and rovers clustered around it. Because they were holding the Congress in a warehouse tent, there wasn't the same party scene that had existed after hours in Dorsa Brevia, but the delegates often stayed up, sitting on the floors of their rooms, drinking and talking about the day's work or the revolution just passed. Many of the people there had never met before and were getting to know each other. Relationships were forming. Romances, friendships, feuds. It was a good time to talk and learn more about what was going on during the daytime Congress. It was the underside of the Congress, the social hour, out there scattered in concrete rooms. Art enjoyed it. And then the moment would come when he would suddenly hit the wall, a wave of sleepiness would roll over him, and sometimes he wouldn't even have time to stagger back to his offices, to the couch next to Nadia's. He would simply roll over on the floor and sleep there, waking stiff and cold to hurry off to their bathroom, a shower, and back to the kitchens to start up that day's kava and java. Round and round, his days a blur. It was glorious. In sessions on many different subjects, people were having to grapple with questions of scale. Without any nations, without any natural or traditional political units, who governed what? And how were they to balance the local against the global and past versus future, the many ancestral cultures against the one Martian culture? Sax, observing this recurring problem from the rocket ship to Earth, sent back a message proposing that the tent towns and covered canyons become the principal political units. City-states, basically, with no larger political units except for the global government itself, which would regulate only truly global concerns. Thus, there would be local and global, but no nation-states in between. The reaction to this proposal was fairly positive. For one thing, it had the advantage of conforming to the situation that already existed. Mikhail, leader of the Bogdanovist party, noted that it was a variant of the old commune of communes, and because Sax had been the source of the suggestion, this quickly got it called the Lab of Labs plan. But the underlying problem still remained, as Nadia quickly pointed out. All Sax had done was define their particular local and global. They still had to decide just how much power the proposed global confederation was going to have over the proposed semi-autonomous city-states. Too much, and it was back to a big centralized state, Mars itself as a nation, a thought which many delegations abhorred. But too little, Jackie said emphatically in the human rights workshop, and there could be tents out there deciding slavery is okay, or female genital mutilation is okay, or any other crime based on some Terran barbarism is okay, excused in the name of cultural values, and that is just not acceptable. Jackie is right, Nadia said, which was unusual enough to get people's attention. People claiming that some fundamental right is foreign to their culture, that stinks no matter who says it. Fundamentalists, patriarchs, Leninists, metanats, I don't care who. They aren't going to get away with it here, not if I can help it. Art noticed more than a few delegates frowning at this sentiment, which no doubt struck them as a version of Western secular relativism, or perhaps John Boone's hyper-Americanism. Opposition to the metanats had included many people trying to hold on to their older cultures, and these often had their hierarchies pretty well intact. The ones at the top end of the hierarchies liked them that way, and so did a surprisingly large number of people farther down the ladder. The young Martian natives, however, looked surprised that this was even considered an issue. To them, the fundamental rights were innate and irrevocable, and any challenge to that struck them as just one more of the many emotional scars that the Issei were always revealing as a result of their traumatic, dysfunctional Terran upbringings. Ariadne, one of the most prominent of the young natives, stood up to say that the Dorsa Brevia group had studied many Terran human rights documents and had written a comprehensive list of their own. The new master list of fundamental individual rights was available for discussion and, she implied, adoption wholesale. Some argued about one point or another, but it was generally agreed that a global bill of rights of some kind should be on the table. So Martian values as they existed in M-Year 52 were about to be codified and made a principal component of the Constitution. The exact nature of these rights was still a matter of controversy. The so-called political rights were generally agreed to be self-evident, things citizens were free to do, things governments were forbidden to do. Habeas corpus, freedom of movement, of speech, of association, of religion, a ban on weapons, all these were approved by a vast majority of Martian natives, though there were some Issei from places like Singapore, Cuba, Indonesia, Thailand, China, and so on, who looked askance at so much emphasis on individual liberty. Other delegates had reservations about a different kind of right. The so-called social or economic rights, such as the right to housing, health care, education, employment, a share of the value generated by natural resource use, etc. Many Issei delegates with actual experience in Terran government were quite worried about these, pointing out that it was dangerous to enshrine such things in the Constitution. It had been done on Earth, they said, and then when it was found impossible to meet such promises, the Constitution guaranteeing them was seen as a propaganda device and flouted in other areas as well until it became a bad joke. Even so, Mikhail said sharply, if you can't afford housing, then it is your right to vote that is the bad joke. The young natives agreed, as did many others there. So economic or social rights were on the table, too, and arguments over how actually to guarantee these rights in practice continued through many a long session. Political, social, it's all one, Nadia said. Let's make all the rights work. So the work went on, both around the big table and in the offices where the subgroups were meeting. Even the UN was there in the person of UNTA Chief Derek Hastings himself, who had come down the elevator and was participating vigorously in the debates, his opinion always carrying a peculiar kind of weight. He even began to exhibit symptoms of hostage syndrome, Art thought, becoming more and more sympathetic the more he stood around in the warehouse arguing with people, and this might affect his superiors on Earth as well. Comments and suggestions were also pouring in from all over Mars and from Earth as well, filling several screens covering one wall of the big room. Interest in the Congress was high everywhere, rivaling even Earth's great flood in the public's attention. "The soap opera of the moment," Art said to Nadia. Every night the two of them met in their little office suite and put in their call to Nergal and the rest. The delays in the travelers' responses got longer and longer, but Art and Nadia didn't really mind. There was a lot to think about while waiting for Sax and the others' part of the conversation to arrive. "This global versus local problem is going to be hard," Art said one night. "It's a real contradiction, I think. I mean, it's not just the result of confused thinking. We truly want some global control, and yet we want freedom for the tents as well. Two of our most essential values are in contradiction." "Maybe the Swiss system," Nergal suggested a few minutes later. "That's what John Boone always used to say." But the Swiss on Pavonis were not encouraging about this idea. "A counter-model, rather," Jürgen said, making a face. "The reason I'm on Mars is the Swiss federal government. It stifles everything. You need a license to breathe." "And the cantons have no power anymore," Priska said. "The federal government took it away." "In some of the cantons," Jürgen added, "this was a good thing," Priska said. "More interesting than Bern might be the Graubünden. That means Grey League. They were a loose confederation of towns in southeast Switzerland for hundreds of years, a very successful organization." "Could you call up whatever you can get on that?" Art said. The next night, he and Nadia looked over descriptions of the Graubünden that Priska had sent over. Well, there was a certain simplicity to affairs during the Renaissance, Art thought. Maybe that was wrong, but somehow the extremely loose agreements of the little Swiss mountain towns didn't seem to translate well to the densely interpenetrated economies of the Martian settlements. The Graubünden hadn't had to worry about generating unwanted changes in the atmospheric pressure, for instance. No, the truth was, they were in a new situation. There was no historical analogy that would be much help to them now. "Speaking of global versus local," Harishka said, "what about the land outside the tents and covered canyons?" She was emerging as the leading Red remaining on Pavonis, a moderate who could speak for almost all wings of the Red movement, therefore becoming quite a power as the weeks passed. "That's most of the land on Mars, and all we said at Dorsa Brevia is that no individual can own it, that we are all stewards of it together. That's good as far as it goes, but as the population rises and new towns are built, it's going to be more and more of a problem figuring out who controls it." Art sighed. This was true, but too difficult to be welcome. Recently, he had made a resolution to devote the bulk of his daily efforts to attacking what he and Nadia judged to be the worst outstanding problem they were facing, and so in theory, he was happy to recognize them. But sometimes they were just too hard, as in this case. Land use, the Red objection. More aspects of the global-local problem, but distinctively Martian. Again, there was no precedent, still, as it was probably the worst outstanding problem. Art went to the Reds. The three who met with him were Marion, Irishka, and Tiu, one of Nergal and Jackie's creche mates from Zygote. They took Art out to their rover camp, which made him happy. It meant that despite his Praxis background, he was now seen as a neutral or impartial figure, as he wanted to be. A big, empty vessel, stuffed with messages, and passed along. The Reds' encampment was west of the warehouses, on the rim of the caldera. They sat down with Art in one of their big upper-level compartments in the glare of a late afternoon sun, talking and looking down into the giant silhouetted country of the caldera. So what would you like to see in this Constitution? Art said. He sipped the tea they had given him. His hosts looked at each other, somewhat taken aback. Ideally, Marion said after a while, we'd like to be living on the primal planet, in caves and cliff dwellings, or excavated crater rings. No big cities, no terraforming. You'd have to stay suited all the time. That's right, we don't mind that. Well, Art thought it over. Okay, but let's start from now. Given the situation at this moment, what would you like to see happen next? No further terraforming. The cable gone and no more immigration. In fact, it would be nice if some people went back to Earth. They stopped speaking, stared at him. Art tried not to let his consternation show. He said, Isn't the biosphere likely to grow on its own at this point? It's not clear, Tiu said. But if you stop the industrial pumping, any further growth would certainly be very slow. It might even lose ground, as with this ice age that's starting. Isn't that what some people call ecopoiesis? No. The eco-poets just use biological methods to create changes in the atmosphere and on the surface, but they're very intensive with them. We think they all should stop, eco-poets or industrialists or whatever. But especially the heavy industrial methods, Marion said. And most especially the inundation of the North. That's simply criminal. We'll blow up those stations no matter what happens here if they don't stop. Art gestured out at the huge stony caldera. The higher elevations look pretty much the same, right? They weren't willing to admit that. Irishka said, Even the high ground shows ice deposition and plant life. The atmosphere lofts high here, remember? No place escapes when the winds are strong. What if we tented the four big calderas? Art said. Kept them sterile underneath with the original atmospheric pressure and mix. Those would be huge wilderness parks preserved in the true primal state. Parks are just what they would be. I know, but we have to work with what we have now, right? We can't go back to M1 and rerun the whole thing, and given the current situation, it might be good to preserve three or four big places in the original state or close to it. It would be nice to have some canyons protected as well, Tiu said tentatively. Clearly, they hadn't considered this kind of possibility before, and it wasn't really satisfactory to them, Art could see. But the current situation couldn't be wished away. They had to start from there. Or Argyre Basin. At the very least, keep Argyre dry. Art nodded encouragingly. Combine that kind of preservation with the atmosphere limits set in the Dorsa Brevia document. There's a 5-kilometer breathable ceiling, and there's a hell of a lot of land above 5 kilometers that would remain relatively pristine. It won't take the Northern Ocean away, but nothing's going to do that now. Some form of slow ecopoiesis is about the best you can hope for at this point, right? Perhaps that was putting it too baldly. The Reds stared down into Pavona's caldera unhappily, thinking their own thoughts. Say the Reds come on board, Art said to Nadia. What do you think the next worst problem is? What? She had been nearly asleep listening to some tinny old jazz from her AI. Ah, Art. Her voice was low and quiet. The Russian accent light, but distinct. She sat slumped on the couch. A pile of paper balls lay around her feet like pieces of some structure she was putting together. The Martian way of life. Her face was oval under a cap of straight white hair, the wrinkles of her skin somehow wearing away as if she were a pebble in the stream of years. She opened her flecked eyes, luminous and arresting under their Cossack eyelids. A beautiful face, looking now at Art perfectly relaxed. The next worst problem. Yes, she smiled. Where did that calmness come from, that relaxed smile? She wasn't worried about anything these days. Art found it surprising, given the political high-wire act they were performing. But then again, it was politics, not war. And just as Nadia had been terribly frightened during the revolution, always tense, always expecting disaster, she was now always relatively calm. As if to say, nothing that happens here matters all that much. Tinker with the details all you want. My friends are safe. The war is over. This that remains is a kind of game, or work, like construction work, full of pleasures. Art moved around to the back of the couch, massaged her shoulders. Ah, she said. Problems. Well, there are a lot of problems that are about equally sticky. Like what? Like, I wonder if the Magyaris will be able to adapt to democracy. I wonder if everyone will accept Vlad and Marina's eco-economics. I wonder if we can make a decent police. I wonder if Jackie will try to create a system with a strong president and use the natives' numerical superiority to become queen. She looked over her shoulder, laughed at Art's expression. I wonder about a lot of things. Should I go on? Maybe not, she laughed. You go on. That feels good. These problems, they aren't so hard. We'll just keep going to the table and pounding away at them. Maybe you could talk to Zake. Okay. But now to my neck.
This ends side two of cassette four of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 5.